This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Wisconsin is the top producer of cranberries in the U.S., harvesting more than 60% of America's annual crop. Many of these bogs are in Monroe, Jackson, and neighboring counties, attracting tourism and contributing to the local economy. But demand for cranberries hasn't grown enough to keep up with record harvests over the last few years. Joining us to talk about the challenges faced by the cranberry industry is Tom Lochner, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association. So, you know, Tom, can you first start by talking a little bit about the current state of the cranberry industry for people who might not be aware of kind of what the challenges that producers have faced over the last few years?
As you mentioned, Wisconsin is a leading producer of cranberries in the world and will account for about a little over 60% of the U.S. crop this year. And we've been leading the country in production for almost 25 years now. So it's a major crop, and Wisconsin is a leader in the industry across the country. We're the state's largest fruit crop, and we probably generate about $1 billion of economic activity each year here in Wisconsin and provide jobs for about 4,000 Wisconsin residents. And that's if you take all of the activity that goes on from the farm to the through the processing and to the ultimately to the end consumer. So cranberries are a pretty good sized business here in Wisconsin, and we're an important part of Wisconsin diverse agriculture. In recent years, we've seen that, as you mentioned, our sales are not keeping pace with our ability to grow fruit. And as a result, we've been accumulating inventories and excess supply of fruit, primarily in juice concentrate. So the industry has taken a number of steps to try and address that situation. First off, we're looking at the supply side of the issue to slow down the growth in supply. The U.S. Cranberry Marketing Committee, which is a federal cranberry marketing order and a tool that the industry has, is recommended to the U.S. Department of Agriculture that we withhold 15% of this year's crop from the market, and that in 2018 that growers only deliver about 75% of a normal crop. And these two efforts are short-term. They are drastic and something that we don't do lightly. I don't know any farmers that want to not produce food, but it's something that's necessary for us to move and get things moving in the right direction. More importantly than that, though, is the industry is making investments in growing new markets, both domestically and internationally. And we hope and we know that the long-term solution to the economic situation that our growers face is to grow demand for cranberries and cranberry products.
I want to return to what you were talking about with the U.S. Cranberry Marketing Committee asking the USDA to cap the amount of cranberries grown next year. Have you heard back from the USDA on this issue? Will this happen?
No, we haven't heard, and we hope to hear fairly soon. The recommendation was made back in August, and the process of review is taking place at USDA, and we're just waiting to hear from them. And hopefully that'll occur within the next few weeks so that the industry can respond to the decision by USDA.
And can you talk about, you know, when was the last time we maybe saw the cranberry industry or another industry limit production in order to kind of help improve the market?
Well, for cranberries, the marketing committee has been around since the 1960s, and it was used in the 1960s when we were in a severe situation. We also had some efforts to limit supply in 1999 and 2000, and those efforts helped us to hold supply down a little bit while we were able to build demand for the products. And after 2000 and 2001, we saw inventory start to line up with demand, and grower returns improved to a level where growers were profitable.
And you mentioned, you know, this will definitely have an impact on individual growers in our state and around the country. I mean, what could those impacts look like?
Well, I think it's in general, growers will be, in the short term, will be paid for less fruit, and the prices they're receiving for the fruit is lower right now than the cost of producing that fruit. So on the commodity pricing side of things, we hope to see that this action is going to signal to the market that the supplies are going to start tightening up and we'll see some improvement in grower returns. From an individual grower standpoint, it may cause, and we have seen some economic stress on some of our growers. We have seen some growers exit the business. Those farms, unfortunately, even though they have gone out of business, and those are individual tragedies that those families face, but at the same time, those farms don't go out of production. Cranberry marshes, once they're planted, will produce indefinitely. So what generally happens is those properties are acquired by another grower, and they continue to grow a crop. And even though the growers exited the business, the production is still there. So it does cause some individual problems. Growers are going to see lower returns, and hopefully we'll be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel in a couple of years when supplies are down a little bit. But more importantly, our biggest challenge is to build demand. And in the long-term solution to the industry's issues that we face economically is to build that demand both domestically and internationally.
I want to take a step back here and really talk about how the industry ended up here.
Well, I think there's a number of factors. We're, like all farmers, depend upon Mother Nature, and we've seen improved yields per acre. We've seen good growing conditions the last few years. We've seen additional acreage come into production. When we look back in the years 2000 through 2007 or 8, there were prices were favorable and growers responded to the market by bringing additional acreage into production or renovating less productive acreage and making that more productive. So we saw a little bit of growth here in Wisconsin in acreage. I think in around 2000-2003, in that time frame, we were at about 17,000 acres, and right now we've grown to about 21,000. We've been at that level for about 4 years now, so we haven't seen a lot of growth in Wisconsin acreage, but our yields have gone up substantially. We've also seen additional acreage go in Canada, primarily in Quebec. If you go back 20 years, there weren't any cranberries grown in Quebec. Today, Quebec is the second largest producing area. They are passing Massachusetts in terms of total production. So that's where the supply has come from. But we also, at the same time, saw that demand was increasing for the product during that time period. And probably starting about in 2012, 2013, we started to see our inventory numbers begin to grow as our productive capacity began to outstrip our ability to sell the fruit. And as a result, we're growing sales at probably 3-4% a year, and more crops were growing and supply was growing at about 5-7% a year. And the challenge for us is to get that demand curve to start moving back up to growing where we're matching our ability to produce. Part of our challenge is that right now we're in the beverage industry or the beverage business. We sell cranberry juice. Most people look at cranberries as a holiday tradition. They see fresh fruit this time of year. But in reality, only about 3-5% of the crop is sold as fresh fruit. Most of it is sold during the rest of the year as a processed product, although the holidays are our largest sales period. Well, between Christmas and Thanksgiving, we will sell probably about 20% of our annual sales occur during that time period. But cranberry juice drinks are the big part of our market, and those markets have been fairly flat. And that's across the board on all beverages that have been relatively flat, whether it's cranberry juice or other kinds of juices. The only growth in the beverage market right now is bottled water. So we've seen where across that category, it's been relatively stable in sales. Dried cranberry sales have done very well, and we need to get another product and start moving a little bit more juice and convince the consumer to consume juice as a healthy alternative.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the future of Wisconsin's cranberry industry, how producers and manufacturers are working to improve the market. We're here with Tom Lochner from the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association. You were just talking about how juice sales have, not been as positive, I guess, as you guys have been hoping and really not seeing that popularity among juice. So, you know, what do you think will be kind of the next generation of cranberry products?
Well, if I knew that, I'd be one of the smarter people in the industry. I think right now the companies and the people are in the marketing and the product development are looking for those products, and it's going to be a combination of some type of beverage. We're seeing looking at enhancing nutritional values of waters, for example. There are some products out there that extract the good things that are in cranberry and put them in water that can be sold. We're also seeing changes in juice blends, and there's some additional ones that are coming out that are that have some very unique flavors to them. We're also looking at reducing sugar content in the beverages and to give the consumer the type of product that they want. We're also seeing some improvements in some of the sauces and some of the more specialty products that people buy, whether it's cranberry salsa or cranberry barbecue sauce or specialized products that are made generally by small startup companies. Here in Wisconsin, we see a number of those. So it's a little bit of all of the above to try and build that. Over the long haul, we just need to start moving a little bit more product. And international markets right now hold out a tremendous opportunity for us.
I wonder if there is another industry that you guys are really looking to for inspiration. You know, another industry that has faced similar challenges and maybe kind of come out the other side of that or is working towards, you know, the other side of these challenges.
There's probably some examples out there, both on managing a little bit of the supply, but more so on the marketing. I think almonds come to mind in terms of a commodity that has done real well, and primarily in the overseas markets, but marketing almonds on their health benefits and their flavor and things like that. So we look at a little bit of what they're doing, look at a little bit of what they've been doing in some overseas markets as well. I think overall, it's just a matter of following and trying to be a leader, which the industry always has been a leader in new product development and new market development. So we've always set the tone. We look around for other good ideas, but at the end of the day, we've got a very unique product. It has a unique flavor, and it also has a lot of unique health benefits that we just have to put into the consumer's hand and get the information to the consumer about the unique taste of cranberries and also the health benefits that are associated with incorporating them into your diet.
You know, you've mentioned that, you know, increasing exports and looking for new international markets for cranberries is important. And later, we're actually going to hear a special report on what some cranberry growers are doing to reach out to places like China and India. But I wonder if you can talk about, you know, why are exports so important to this equation?
Cranberries are native to North America, so they've been around Wisconsin, and they've been around North America before white settlement. The Native Americans traded cranberries. They consumed them. They used them in their diets. And they had a variety of uses for them. They used them as a trade item. With European settlement, we learned how to cultivate them and learned how to grow crops from them. But cranberries were here. They were in Massachusetts when the first colonists came over. They were in Wisconsin when European settlement took place here. So people are, in the U.S. at least, in most places, are familiar with cranberries. They don't grow overseas. They don't grow in Europe. They don't grow in Asia. They don't grow elsewhere. So there's a huge untapped market there for us to go in with our product. We've had success here in domestically in marketing products to the consumers, and we see domestic demand growing, just not as fast a pace as we would like it to. But overseas, we see a lot of interest. We go into markets. We talk to people there in country. We talk to companies in country, and they're very enthused about how they can incorporate cranberries into their products. And so the countries we've gone into, we've had great success in growing the markets there. Back in 2000, 2001, we were exporting about 5 to 10% of the crop. Last year, we exported about 37% of the crop. So there's a lot of potential for growth there and a lot of opportunity. Europe has been a real good market for us. Mexico has been a good market for us. The UK. And now we're seeing interest in China and India. We had a group out in South Korea, as well as Australia and New Zealand. We've had a lot of interest on the part of buyers from other countries, and we've promoted a lot with trade missions through the U.S. Cranberry Marketing Committee and their efforts overseas to get product into those markets.
Are we just in a situation where we're producing too much and we need to cut back?
Well, I think we're in a situation, and for people that are in agriculture, we're always optimistic at the end of the day. And I think for us, we see opportunity out there. I know we as an organization conduct a lot of sampling and promotion in state, just at events in and around Wisconsin. We have partnerships with UW Badgers. We have partnerships with the Packers and the Brewers and the American Birkebeiner and other groups. And as we appear at those and we provide samples, we hear nothing but positive things from consumers about how much they like cranberries. And we have the opportunity to talk to them about how they can incorporate them and use them differently. State Fair is another great venue where we have a lot of conversation directly with consumers, and we hear very positive things. And they are looking for unique ways to incorporate cranberries into their diets as well. So we're optimistic about that. And we think if we can tell the story of cranberries, not only here in Wisconsin, but elsewhere in the U.S., and get product into people's hands overseas as well, we're just optimistic that the opportunities are there. The marketing people tell us that the opportunities are there, and we're going to pursue those. So at the end of the day, we can get ourselves in a position where our growers continue to be able to be sustainable economically.
Earlier, you mentioned that, you know, we have seen a few growers go out of business just because of how tough the market is right now. Do you have an estimate for how many growers in our state we've seen close their doors?
I don't have a number off the top of my head. Right now we have about 250 growers in Wisconsin on 21,000 acres. We've probably seen, a half a dozen to a dozen growers who have gone out. We've also seen some growers that may have left the business and exited, but it was more from a retirement situation and not having anyone in the family to pass the farm along to that was interested in passing the farm along to. But at the same time, one of the things that I've noticed over the last 5 or 6 years is a tremendous influx of young people back into the business, into the family businesses. They've gone off, they've gone to school, they've worked in the so-called real world, and they decided to come back to the family farm to be cranberry growers, and that's pretty exciting for us. And going to our meetings, we see a lot of young faces there that have a lot of enthusiasm for the business and a lot of enthusiasm about growing cranberries, and that's one of the reasons I'm real optimistic about the future of the industry here, is that we do have people that are coming back into it. We have quite a good group of young growers that are much more educated, willing to adopt technology, and looking to learn how to grow cranberries in the most economically and environmentally sustainable way that they can, and to maintain that family tradition.
Yeah, you mentioned the family tradition part of growing cranberries, and you know, I think we've talked about how cranberries are really part of Wisconsin's history. You know, I wonder if you can talk about how this industry is so much more for these communities where, you know, these cranberry bogs are located.
Most of the cranberry production's in central Wisconsin. If you're people familiar with Wisconsin, right in the heart of the state, if you draw a line from Stevens Point through Wisconsin Rapids to Black River Falls down to Toma, back up to Stevens Point, you're going to account for about, you know, well over two-thirds of the cranberry production. You're also not going to see a whole lot of people in those areas. It's a very rural area, and cranberries are really the lifeblood of a lot of those communities. Growers tend to spend money locally. They hire locally. Because of the nature of our growing practices, a lot of the equipment that we use is specialized, and that's made at the small machine shops in communities like Warrens and Toma and Black River Falls and Wisconsin Rapids. We see a lot of those local communities who really rely on the family farms that are growing cranberries. And we say family farms. We have many multi-generation farms. I'll be spending the rest of this week with some of our young leadership, and we're looking at people in that group that are in the sixth or seventh generation that are taking over on the farms. So those families have been in it for a long time. It's part of the community's blood, and I think it gets in the family tradition that, you know, most parents hope that their children will come back to the farm, and I think in our cases a lot of them do, because it's not only been a good business to be in, but the lifestyle itself in the rural area, working outdoors. We have tons of wildlife on Cranberry Marshes and a lot of activity that goes around, a lot of camaraderie between the growers, and it's just a real vibrant community to be around.
Tom Lochner, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association, is here with us today to talk about challenges faced by the state's cranberry producers and how the industry is working to grow the market. Now, we'll hear from WPR's Rich Kramer on how producers are working to grow demand for cranberries by expanding markets overseas.
In late September, more than 100,000 people converged on the tiny village of Warrens for a three-day celebration of the cranberry. Among the revelers were a group of friends from Green Bay who rode 3 hours by bus to shop and sample the cranberry-laced foods.
Well, we're on our way to get the sausage and the cranberry cheese right over on the corner there.
And they have cranberry cream puffs. If you try them, they're supposed to be delicious.
But despite the merriment in Warrens, the Wisconsin cranberry industry has faced challenges over the last few years. In 2016, the state saw a record harvest, and this year's projections aren't far behind. That would be a good thing, but demand isn't keeping pace, and prices for fresh fruit have fallen by 20%. So the industry is working to grow new demand in China and India. Tom Lochner of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association says that means introducing the fruit to people who have never heard of it.
We're introducing people to cranberry. So when we go into, whether it's Western Europe or UK or Asia, they don't even have words for cranberry, and they don't know what they are. So we have to tell them what the fruit is and then convince them to eat it.
That convincing starts with a bus full of Chinese and Indian business leaders, bloggers, and social media influencers visiting the Cutler Cranberry Farm in Camp Douglas. This is what the U.S. Cranberry Marketing Committee calls a reverse trade mission. The goal is to educate the visitors about how cranberries are grown, harvested, and packed. Then they'll go back home and spread the word. Mabel Zhuang is a consultant for the cranberry industry in China. In 2013, she was part of the first U.S.-branded campaign there.
At that time, we did a survey. Less than 4% of the Chinese consumers are aware of cranberry as a fruit. Compared with a blueberry, strawberry, they have very high awareness rate. But after 5 years promotion, now the awareness rate has increased to over 50%. It's a huge increase in the past 5 years.
That success has been with dried berries in bread, cookies, and packages of mixed nuts. This year, the marketing committee made its first moves in India. Ravindra Yadav is an international trade consultant for Technopak Advisors, a contractor for the U.S. cranberry industry. He says only a small percentage of the population has ever heard of the fruit, so he's trying to incorporate it into the local cuisine.
Taking it as a health supplement is absolutely okay. Cranberry juice is picking up. But to, you know, have it as a part of the daily meal, that is a kind of challenge, but I think we are working on it. We have hired a few chefs who would be developing recipes, Indian recipes around cranberries.
After donning waders and walking through a flooded cranberry bed, the delegation toured the processing building at the Cutler Cranberry Company, where berries are dried, sorted, and packed. Seattle-based marketing committee consultant Brooks Erickson helped organize the tour. He says growing demand overseas will take time, but is vitally important.
In terms of for this specific trip, China and India are really huge markets that we've just gotten started in, and I think that for the future health of this industry, it'll be important to continue to invest in them to really increase the demand overseas.
The reverse trade mission cost around $60,000 and was paid for by federal grants and fees paid on each barrel of cranberries. While growers wait for their labors in Asia to bear fruit, they're hopeful the long-term strategy will stabilize the market and improve prices. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's Rich Kramer, talking about how Wisconsin producers are working to grow demand for cranberries by bringing the fruit overseas. Coming up, we'll talk about another fall topic in Wisconsin, deer hunting. Wildlife officials in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa weigh in on how chronic wasting disease has impacted the regional deer population and how they're working to address the issue. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. As deer season begins around the region, some wildlife officials will also be starting stricter regulations to monitor for and manage chronic wasting disease. Minnesota required CWD testing during the season's opening weekend earlier this month, and counties around the region are encouraging hunters to voluntarily test for the disease. Joining us to talk about how CWD is affecting the region are Lou Cornicelli, Wildlife Research Manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Terry Hainfield, wildlife biologist with the Iowa DNR, and Tammy Ryan, chief of the Wildlife Health Program for the Wisconsin DNR. And so first I want to start by talking a little bit about Minnesota's opening weekend and the CWD testing that you guys required. So Lou, you know, tell us a little bit about why Minnesota wanted to require that testing.
Well, much like the other Midwestern states, we've been actively looking for CWD since it was first discovered in Wisconsin in 2002. And since 2002, we've tested probably close to 60,000 deer, but our most recent rounds of surveillance are related to a positive detection in Fillmore County, which is in southeastern Minnesota, in wild deer, of which we still don't know the cause, and that was last fall. And then last winter, there were two farm service facilities that were declared infected. So we are doing surveillance around those infected facilities. So our strategy was to, for this fall, was to kind of take Missouri's approach and force people through sampling stations over opening weekend of the deer season to get as many samples as we could in our surveillance areas.
And so how did that go? I'm sure there was a lot of coordination that went into that effort.
There was. I'm suspecting D-Day was slightly less complex, but this was pretty complicated to put together. We had we have a system of online and over-the-phone registration for deer, and we didn't want to turn that off because it's really popular. So we were essentially telling hunters that go ahead and register your deer in the manner that you see fit, and then bring it to a sampling station. So we had to also figure out where we should put the sampling stations because they have to be large enough to accommodate potentially masses of people. They have to be laid out in a safe way. We have to have safety plans for our staff, all the protocols related to sampling. So we've been pretty much planning this for since January, February, when we found out about the infected facility. So it's been a fairly large coordinated sampling effort, and it worked amazingly well. Our results, or at least our compliance, was really high, not as high as Missouri, but it was high enough for us that we, in some areas, we doubled the numbers collected versus the numbers desired.
And Tammy, can you talk a little bit about, what has Wisconsin's approach to CWD been? You know, what's kind of been the state's plan?
So we've been conducting surveillance of CWD in the Wisconsin deer herd since 2002 when it was first detected. So fast forward now to 2017, and we have sampled over 200,000 animals and have had great interest and cooperation by Wisconsin deer hunters. So what we do is every year we establish a surveillance strategy and provide for sampling opportunities in those targeted areas of interest, as well as outside of our targeted areas. We essentially offer hunter service testing for adult deer from any county of the state. But we do have a focused surveillance plan. It is on our website. Hunters can go to the website and check that out and see where our heightened, I guess, areas of interest are. And then we have information on our CWD web pages on where our sampling locations are. And there's, you know, we are in a fairly new era here in Wisconsin with electronic registration, so that, deer still need to be registered after harvest, but that in-person process that was long in place is no longer. And we have more convenient opportunities now for hunters to just register their deer afield. But we still do offer in-person opportunities for CWD sampling. We have a network of cooperators out there that are working hard to help us provide this service to the hunters. We also have self-service opportunities. There's what we refer to as kiosks, where hunters can basically do it themselves if they'd like to. So lots of information available at their fingertips on how they can get their deer sampled this year.
Has Wisconsin considered requiring testing?
We have required testing. That's something, 15 years running, that's something that we did do in the onset of our following our detection. But now our approach is a voluntary approach and an encouragement approach, and doing what we can to make the opportunities for CWD sampling convenient.
Actually, earlier this week, our Eau Claire talk show, the West Side, happened to be talking about CWD, and an interesting point came up from a former Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources board member, Dave Clausen, had a comment that I wanted to play for you guys, just to hear your reaction about, I don't know, how neighboring states have viewed Wisconsin's approach to CWD. So we're going to play that now.
When Iowa discovered their first case of CWD in the wild across from Crawford County, the text that was going around was a picture of a deer wearing a Packer cheesehead hat, and on it said Iowa or bust. So there's very definitely concern. And there is huge concern in Michigan. They are really upset in the Upper Peninsula because we have those three game farms up there that continue to operate and continue to pose a threat to the deer in that area and also to Michigan. That was mentioned. I talked with some of the folks from Michigan, and they are not happy about our approach.
Tammy, do you feel like that's, I don't know, an accurate viewpoint?
I can't really speak to the viewpoints of Dr. Clausen or, I guess, the Michigan DNR in regards to Wisconsin's approach. I guess I would offer, however, that, back in 2002 and the years following, Wisconsin really put a significant effort into CWD and responding to the disease on our landscape. And it's something that, now looking back on that and with the data that we've been able, the expansive data set that we've been able to collect, there is modeling that's been done that actually shows that even though at the time that we detected it, we thought we were responding to an isolated case, what we didn't know then that we know now is that the disease was actually likely to be present on our landscape for at least a couple of decades prior to our detection. So, we definitely found ourselves in a difficult circumstance, but we tried very hard in the early years to contain and eliminate the disease.
Terry, you know, this clip mentioned Iowa, Iowa's kind of response. I wonder, you know, kind of what your perspective is on, I don't know, how Iowa's kind of approaching this CWD issue.
There is great respect for each of the state's agencies of how they've dealt with chronic wasting disease. And it's very important to point out to the viewers or listeners here, every state with chronic wasting disease has its own set of parameters with this disease with respect to its infection situation. And I usually break this down into two areas, biology and management. So that's the location of the disease, the habitat types, dispersals of deer, number of infected animals, terrain, cervid population, the landowners, the seasons. And then there's also the public and the politics side, whether it's the hunter attitudes, laws, politics, CWD knowledge, who's got authority for what types of rules or regulations. So we all have different situations, and we all deal with them in the best way we can scientifically to curtail this disease. And so there's great respect in this tri-state area for how each of the managers are performing and doing their jobs on this.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about how state wildlife officials are responding to chronic wasting disease and its impact on regional deer populations. We're here with Terry Hainfield from the Iowa DNR, Lou Cornicelli from the Minnesota DNR, and Tammy Ryan from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Terry was just mentioning, you know, this respect in this between the different state agencies. Lou, I wonder if you could talk about, I don't know, have there been efforts to kind of coordinate resources on this issue?
Certainly not, resources being sharing equipment, no, but we coordinate knowledge base and we coordinate research projects that we're going to doing that we do to try and answer some of the same questions in the different states. So we work very closely with our neighboring states. And I think we're meeting here in December to talk about some research projects that we're all doing. So we work as closely as we can, recognizing our state borders and state differences. Like Terry mentioned, different states have different regulatory authorities and different political landscapes. I can speak for my state. We have broad regulatory authority to manage for wildlife diseases. So we can open and close seasons. We can impose carcass export restrictions. We can do all sorts of stuff that some states might not be able to do. And like Tammy had mentioned before, and then Terry then reiterated, it really depends on that landscape, when you found the disease and what you feel like you can do about it. So I think there's a lot of differences in each state's CWD detection and management, but there's a lot of similarities as well, and we do work very closely together on a lot of that stuff.
It seems like sampling is definitely an important part of each of your state's strategy. And Tammy, I wonder if you can talk about why sampling is so important to helping manage CWD.
Sure. Well, sampling can be basically broken down into two primary purposes, and the first is disease detection surveillance, so essentially conducting sampling to detect disease on the landscape so that, management actions and information can be shared with the public. Then there's assessment surveillance, which essentially follows a detection. So that surveillance and that sampling informs further knowledge about the disease on the landscape in regards to disease distribution and ultimately over time tracking trends and prevalence.
This has been an ongoing issue for a number of years, and I wonder, what have been, I guess, the biggest advances or improvements and how states are able to, monitor for and kind of track where this disease is going?
Well, my mind goes to more or less the protocols or the field operation protocols of testing itself. Back in the beginning in Wisconsin anyway, it was the first time CWD was detected east of the Mississippi River, and we We did start off with efforts to collect samples, and it was primarily done through the collection of deer heads and you know, freezing those deer heads and then extracting tissues from thousands of deer heads and trimming all those tissues. And now here we are 15 years later, and, you know, we're actually training our cooperators who are providing CWD sampling services to extract lymph nodes. We've long been doing that. It's definitely a more efficient process. We're able to move those through the system quicker. Our testing turnaround time has become quicker as a result of that. And further, you know, hunters are able to take their deer home to their families with the head still attached, which is a really important part of the process. And then I guess the other thought that would come to mind is, you know, the advances would be in regards to, you know, what it is that we've learned about CWD over the last 15 years. Like I mentioned, 2002 was when CWD was first detected east of the Mississippi River. But there is a graphic on the CWD Alliance webpage that basically shows North America and what we know about CWD to date. And there's quite a significant wealth of knowledge that's been gained over that time frame and across the nation and Canada in regards to what's happening with disease distribution.
Tammy, you bring up a really interesting issue of teaching people how to remove the lymph nodes to better better be able to test for chronic wasting disease. And I know that the Minnesota DNR actually had an interesting experience with trying to teach more people to be able to do that by using their Facebook page. And I wonder if, Lou, you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the idea actually came from one of our younger assistant area managers who said we should make a video. So we made a couple of videos, one on the just basically the surveillance program, why we're doing it, how to get ready for it, the website, and that had over 40,000 hits on the DNR site alone. So it went kind of crazy. I wish someone else would have been the speaker instead of me, but that's a different conversation. But we also had basically a video on how to extract a lymph node yourself using, I think we used a Leatherman and just a hunting knife. So, and that got a lot of views as well. So we were trying to show our hunters if they were interested in taking their own samples outside of our surveillance area and then processing those themselves through either the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab or Colorado State University. We would give them those tools to do that. So, yeah, it came out of, you know, an idea from one of our area staff, and it just kind of went from there.
Terry, I wonder if this, I don't know, if this, the popularity around this video and just maybe encompasses hunters' awareness, like increased awareness and increased willing to participate in CWD sampling and kind of addressing this issue.
That's a really important, good point that you're making there, Hope, that the education and the information to the public is essential. And I think that's what we've found to resonate with some of our hunters and landowners where we do have chronic wasting disease, is we've done a fair amount of public meetings where nobody likes this disease, but we all need to understand what it is and what it means down the road and what we can all do, you know, to be able to help move this in a better direction. Whether it's from any of the other states or locally. And we found a great reception to that when people really get the pertinent, correct information about what this disease is about.
That's Terry Hainfield, wildlife biologist from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, here with us today to talk about the impact of chronic wasting disease on regional deer populations. Also joining us is Lou Cornicelli from the Minnesota DNR and Tammy Ryan from the Wisconsin DNR. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. So, Terry, I wonder if you can talk about, you know, what's new this fall in Northeast Iowa and when it comes to CWD sampling, but also maybe this year's hunting season.
One of the things is, like I mentioned, public meetings, we're having some more of those. But then also we've had some additional antlerless licenses available in these chronic wasting disease positive areas for people who feel like they have excess deer or want to remove some deer from those areas. That's been very helpful. We also are unfortunately having to watch our western border a little more closely along the Missouri River because the positives are closer from Nebraska. And so we're informing public, you know, over in that part of the region. And the other things that we're trying to do is looking at restricting or not restricting, but improving carcass disposals. So people aren't taking the bones and the remains from deer and putting them in new areas from these CWD-positive areas so we don't spread the disease in other parts of Iowa they're in, out of the region. So we're working to that end as far as providing better resources for the public to help them, have proper management of this disease.
Tammy, what is new here in Wisconsin when it comes to CWD sampling or just kind of the hunting season this fall?
Just the fact that the self-sampling kiosks that we've offered are out there in greater numbers than they have been in the past. So a lot, definitely trying to fill in the gaps on the landscape and provide convenient opportunities for hunters to get their CWD, their deer sampled for CWD. We also have enhanced our efforts on carcass movement as a way to reduce disease spread in our state as well as within our tri-state area. Recently, we collaborated with Lou and his shop over in Minnesota on the outreach to Minnesota hunters that are going to be coming to Wisconsin to hunt deer, and created a new brochure, which is on our website, DNR Wisconsin website, keyword CWD. And that is also being mailed to hunters in Terry State as well as Illinois and Michigan. So we've definitely amped up our efforts to seek to reduce the spread and reduce the risk of spreading CWD in our Great Lakes area.
And Lou, we've talked about the required testing that happened during opening weekend in Minnesota, but anything else that's new this fall?
Well, for us, a lot of it was new last fall after we found CWD. So we've implemented carcass import restrictions into Minnesota from any of the 50 states and Canadian provinces. So we don't allow whole carcasses to come back, kind of from what Terry was talking about regarding risk from other states. So we've limited that. Within our CWD zone, we have a carcass export restriction. So you're not allowed to leave the zone without a not detected result. So the carcass has to stay in the zone. You can leave with cut and wrap meat, cleaned antlers, skull plates, that kind of stuff. And we just had we have a presumptive positive CWD deer in our zone that was taken by a Wisconsin hunter, and we contacted that person, and he had done all the right things. He had boned the meat in the zone, left with clean antlers, and our folks seem to be complying. So we've done what we can both on the import side and also to reduce risk on the export side. So I think, as Tammy said, you know, working together on a lot of stuff, but we're also trying to measure risk both in and out, and whether that's in because of game farms or natural deer movements, or out based on positive detections in our own state.
Terry, I want to hit on one thing really quickly before we go. In other articles, I've read that you have said that, you know, it's probably not possible to eliminate the disease in our region, but, you know, we're working to slow it down as much as possible. And I wonder if, I don't know, if you could comment briefly on that before we go, of this idea that, you know, it might not be possible to eliminate CWD, but, you know, we're doing our best to manage it.
That's very true. There's if you're going to eliminate a positive, a recent found positive, you need to jump on it fast and do quick diligence in that area. But once it gets established, it's very difficult. But the thinking in the scientific world is that we need to slow this down as much as we can, such that science can catch up and give us better tools, that something down the road that we don't even know about yet can help us either really slow it down or maybe even stop this disease. So we're just asking for the public's and everybody's help to do whatever they can, whether it's movement of carcasses across the landscape of or the captive facilities moving deer across, and maybe we'll have a live test someday that can test, live animals. Those are the things we need such that we can have good efforts that are productive with the future of this disease.
We've been talking with Terry Hainfield, wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Lou Cornicelli, wildlife research manager from Minnesota DNR, and Timmy Ryan, chief of the Wildlife Health Program for the Wisconsin DNR, about the spread of chronic wasting disease in the region and how wildlife officials are working to manage the disease this season. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.